Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When video game developer Zoe Quinn broke up with an abusive boyfriend in 2014, he wrote a hateful manifesto that went viral. It destroyed her life for several years. Hackers got into her accounts and published nude photos of her. They stalked her, harassed her family, friends, and colleagues, and threatened to rape and murder her. She writes, "My personal disaster metastasized into the phenomenon known as Gamergate, a new front in the full-blown culture war over the heart and soul of the internet itself. In response to the online harassment, abuse, and privacy invasions she experienced, she founded Crash Override, a crisis helpline and resource center for people experiencing online abuse. Zoe Quinn worked with giant tech companies like Facebook, Twitter, and Google, at least she tried, to also help rewrite their terms of use agreements. She worked with law enforcement and Congress to make policy changes. She testified about online abuse at the UN. Still, she says it's been an uphill battle. Zoe Quinn has written a book about her experience and what we can do to prevent online abuse and maintain some semblance of privacy. It's called Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. At heart, Zoe Quinn is still a video game designer. Her game, Depression Quest, has been played by over 2 million people. And Zoe Quinn joins us in studio today. Hi, Zoe. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you in person because I remember when all of this happened, I read all about it. And I want to start by asking you to talk about how serious this is. Because I'm afraid that a lot of people just don't realize the trauma that so many people endure when they are on the receiving end of this online abuse.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost hard for me to quantify even after the 3 years of dealing with this and having to talk to it. But, I mean, that's definitely something I encountered when I was trying to navigate the legal system. And it's hard to convey what it's like to have thousands of people trying to go through every aspect of your life to try to find some point of failure to bombard. And I know it's like a lot of people are like, oh, it's just the internet. It's like this magical alternate reality that doesn't actually, like, you can just ignore. But that's like increasingly not the case as we see, you know, more and more of our lives intersect with the internet. So, you know, things like your bank account is online. A lot of personal information that you may not have even consented to have out there is online and easily, you know, found. So that's like one of the ways that people were able to, you know, do things like brigade the IRS with like through their reporting thing of false reports about me committing tax fraud to try to get them to audit me. Wow. And things like finding out where I lived and sending me photos of the outside of where I could not go back to because it wasn't safe, and brag about putting dead animals in my mailbox, and like, you know, having to talk to my dad who was getting these weird calls at all hours of the night. And like it's so hard to convey like every single thing that happened along the way too, just because it's like anytime you're trying to explain something serious about the internet, it's very easy to sound either like a Star Trek character going off in techno jargon or kind of like you're out of your mind, because some of these people have like really weird aliases. And it's, you know, very easy, I think, for people who are not tech savvy at all to, you know, be like, oh, it's just, you know, it's hard for me to actually understand, so I can't really tell what this means. So it's easy to dismiss. But it's like, my dad's never really been internet-y. He types with two fingers and stuff like that. And people were threatening him and calling him and stuff like that. So it's like, it doesn't even really matter if you're online or not anymore, especially since, like, there were a few other people that just had the same name as me that became targeted because people were trying to figure out which personal information thing was mine and whose family to harass and stuff like that. And they probably still don't know what the hell happened.
You also write about how so many people say, well, just go offline. It'll pass. You write that you had to go to Boston to make a case to a judge. And as the judge was leaving the room, he said, "You're a smart kid. Find a new career. Just go offline."
Yeah. And it's like, well, there's not really an offline version of what I do. And that's going to be increasingly the case for people that are like sort of growing up now, because if you want to be a small business owner or any kind of entrepreneur or an artist or anything like that, you're probably going to need social media and the internet to get the word out there about yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how me being like this kid who came from a super, super, super small village in rural upstate New York, was able to learn how to program and make video games and distribute them and like build a career for myself. So as more people start living and working online more and more, saying just go offline is going to become more and more nonsense. And it pushes all of the responsibility for dealing with this onto the person who's already targeted. So it's like saying, oh, there's people screaming at you in your front lawn constantly. Just use your back door. What's the problem? It's like, you're kind of missing the point here.
I don't want your life before this abuse happened to get lost. I feel like that happens. So why don't you tell us a little bit about why you're so passionate about video games, and the game that you developed, Depression Quest, has been played by over 2 million people. Yeah. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, I kind of came to game development late in life, even though I'd always kind of loved games. I didn't start programming until I think I was like 25-ish. Because I didn't know games were a thing that you could just make. Like, I thought, oh, you know, this has to have millions of dollars and be made by tons of people, and I'm just one person. But then I got connected with the independent game development community, and there's this whole movement in games that are sort of looking at video games as a new art medium instead of just, you know, maybe what a lot of people are familiar with on the Call of Duty, Mario sort of, like, pop culture representations. But it's actually, like, become such a broad and cool, diverse field. Mm. Like, you've got games about, you know, where you're just going through somebody's house and trying to figure out what happened to them, but it's like this cool story about two queer girls falling in love and running away together and stuff like that. You've got games like mine that talk about mental illness. You've got games that talk about coming out to your parents, and, you know, there's so much room to explore, and such a powerful medium because of this interactive element where, in like, you know, as opposed to films and books and stuff that are super cool, games do something where instead of like the whole show don't tell thing, you can ask to do not tell. Mm-hmm. and like get this person to actively participate and walk through this thing and be be their own actor and have this co-authorship over the medium with you. And that's endlessly exciting to me.
When I was doing research for the show and looking for groups to tag to let them know that you were on, I found all of these incredible organizations that I'd love to have on the show. Lesbians Who Tech is a global community of 25,000 gender nonconforming LGBTQ women and allies in tech. And then I found another one, Trans H4CK. It's an award-winning nonprofit focused on creating visibility for transgender technologists and founders. I mean, there's just so much out there that's we didn't even have a couple years ago.
Yeah, it's really exploded. And that's one of the coolest things about the internet is like now, you know, I can find such specific communities that are like other queer people in tech or other people like that, you know, kind of came from sort of a poor background that are in tech and trying to figure out how to navigate that because it's like, oh, we don't have degrees. And it's kind of weird sometimes. It's great. It's super cool.
We were talking about that before the show. Let's dive into your story. You wrote an entire book about what happened to you called Crash Override. You're going on book tour, and this is all new for you. And I understand that, well, I watched a video when you were at the Strand in New York. Someone yelled during your talk.
Yeah.
And then The Guardian reported that you got a death threat when you were in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah. I get death threats all the time. I think it was just like, I was kind of just... the reporter for The Guardian was cool, so I'm just like, oh, yeah, this thing happened and whatever. And it's kind of weird that that's sort of become my attitude to this. Is like, it's just so common now that it's like, oh, yeah, whatever. I mean, it was a death threat, and it seemed pretty specific, and I figured out who made it, and it was someone who was local and able to carry out on it. So, you know, it's just like, eh, I just got to have specific security measures, whatever. It's another day that ends in Y. And, you know, I made the decision a very long time ago that I wasn't going to sort, you know, like these campaigns of harassment, what I think a lot of the people involved want ultimately, what I know my ex wanted ultimately was to basically make it so that I didn't have a voice anymore and that I was hidden. So it's like, I can take the precautions that I can as much as I can within reason to sort of make myself safe and not take unnecessary risks, because it's like you can't tell if someone's just making a threat to be a jerk and mess with you or if somebody is like the next Dylan Roof or Elliot Rodger because they all did the same thing online. Mm. But at the end of the day, I don't want to live in fear of these people or hide. And I think like after 3 years, you kind of run out of emotion about a thing when it comes to, you can't be scared all the time. Like it's just like you got to move on, right? So I'm like, you know, there's some stuff beyond my control. Like if someone does just decide to like come out to one of these things and like shoot me, I don't think there's much I can do about that.
Wow.
Ultimately, outside of like you know, having security and stuff like that. So I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to put it so it's I'm their problem and not the other way around.
Well, you have to relive this now because you're on book tour, and I'm sure it's really hard, but it also is so important to let people know that this is happening. We've done a lot of shows about this, but every single story is so unique. So what happened? Your ex wrote a hateful manifesto about you, and then it went viral.
Yeah. He sort of engineered it and workshopped it and was, like, posting screenshots later of how he was workshopping it. Sort of the way that marketers would do to, like, make a product go viral or have a really good ad campaign. He was, like, inserting jokes and specific things that he thought would catch fire and spread really well, and then posted in a bunch of places that were the most likely to take it and run with it. And that's exactly what happened. Like, the first night, there were two places that he tried to post it to that immediately took it down because they're like, whoa, this is ridiculous. No, gross, weird. Mm-hmm. And then finally it hit an anonymous message board, and it really blew up from there because they, you know, as much as what happened to me was so deeply personal, it was also, like, not that personal, and that I was a convenient stand-in for a lot of problems people had with, like, people seen as outsiders in video games. And if you don't, like, the further you get away from whatever these people think is, like, the default person, regardless of who's actually playing games or who's actually in the industry, you know, they kick against that, as well as this, like, whole anti-progressive sentiment and this anti-woman, anti-queer person, anti-anybody that doesn't look like a 1950s sitcom dad, basically, sentiment. And it really capitalized on that and sort of, you know, I just became this punching bag for whatever people felt like they needed to project onto me that they were already feeling anxious and weird about.
You write that the original post your ex posted was on WordPress, and it's still up to this day?
Yep.
I was shocked when I learned this. WordPress is a very big company. I'm sure a lot of people have their websites on WordPress. You say that they did not consider it harassment. It's a shame we can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Executives told you.
Yeah, I spoke to, like, the head of their department that handles abuse and stuff like that face-to-face. And this was, like, later on after I had started Crash, because one of the things I was doing was, like, trying to establish escalation channels and be like, hey, let me know what your terms of service is. If someone comes to me that, you know, has a case where someone is absolutely doing something on their platform to them that I know you don't want, let me help you and let me bring this directly to you so you can act on it quicker. So, you know, I had to try to build that, especially because there's a decent amount of revenge porn posted on stuff like WordPress blogs. So, you know, I had to just kind of smile through my teeth and just be like, I had to ask. I'm like, yeah, that blog is still up. Is that you ever going to do anything about that? Because, like, early on I sent, you know, I had a lawyer even send a thing. And they're like, well, you know, it's not technically harassment. It really sucks. We just can't, you know, our hands are tied. I'm like, well, actually, the DA in Massachusetts is preparing to file a harassment case. So, like, even the law disagrees with you, and they're just like, oh. And I just had to kind of be like, well, you know, I get it. Things are hard. Can I still have that escalation channel to help other people? And that was, like, really hard. It's really hard to, you know, file off your edges and not express, you know, the, like, mentally in my head, I'm like, ugh! But, like, I can't be forthright with that with a lot of people in tech because, like, they're so risk averse and they'll freak out and I'll seem like, you know, an angry minority, and you can't do that, otherwise they stop listening to you. And it's such an impossible line to walk.
What was your experience like with other companies like Facebook and Twitter?
It's really all over the place because the thing is, the systems are broken. Just fundamentally, like, the obviously, like, Twitter's prioritizing giving more characters to people over getting Nazis off the platform. And, you know, Facebook has its own issues, but there are good people working within broken systems. So usually it would, like, come down to trying to find people who cared and did want to change things. And unfortunately, what I saw too often was they'd either get burnt out on not being on, like, you know, they'd think, oh, yeah, this is against terms of service. This is wrong. Let's do something about it. And then they would face resistance, or someone higher up in management would suck and be like, oh, well, we can't, you know, but the Nazis, but free speech, though, and stuff like that. Or they would, you know, get promoted and be like, well, now it's politically risky for me to do these things. And, you know, I really want to make sure if I rise further in the ranks, then I can do more. So I have to do less now. And then it just, that's how the systemic stuff works, right? It pushes anybody that isn't already in line with the status quo out.
Today we are speaking with Zoe Quinn about her story of online harassment. We're also talking about her new book, Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Harassment. hate. And Zoe has a number of events coming up. September 27th, that's tonight, at the Brava Theater in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow night at City Lights in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. And October 5th at the Booksmith in San Francisco at 7:30. And we'll put this information on our website, yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions or comments for Zoe about her story and the steps that she took to make sure that this doesn't happen to others, in addition to sharing her story, she also really wants to focus on what it will take to make the internet a safe place for everyone. So if you have any questions about that, if you work in tech, what do you think about these companies and the steps they take or don't take? And if you've ever dealt with online harassment, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. For people who are not familiar with how this abuse works and how quickly things happen, can you talk about that? Because it's shocking to think that so many people took action so quickly after this manifesto was posted.
Yeah, I mean, it was immediate. I didn't actually find the post until I managed to sort of, like, I was getting so much hate already, and I was trying to, like, figure out where this is coming from. And, you know, like, that first night, people were already, like, vandalizing my Wikipedia page to change, like, my date of death to soon. And when that got reverted to, they changed it to, like, my next scheduled public appearance. You know, like, it was, you know, kind of like when kids count thunderclaps, like, the time between thunderclaps to see how far the storm is away. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that with notifications on my phone. Like, it was, like, buzzing and then buzzing and then buzzing and buzzing and buzzing, and I had to just turn it off because it was just like, okay, this is a lot. And it was seriously like within hours, people were already trying to find my home address and find more people that they could like wrap into this weird conspiracy they had in my head, because it was operating on these super old, like one of the oldest accusations against anybody who is seen as an outsider, that, you know, is like a femme or a woman, that's like, oh, you know, this person must have had to sleep with someone to get anything. There's no possible way that they were just, you know, that they worked hard or they were talented or they did anything right, you know. So it's like people were immediately trying to like find the fire, since they were so interested in generating the smoke, that was like basically based on pre-existing biases and like ignorance in their own minds. And it seriously just caught fire immediately. Like, it was just, I couldn't use any of my, like, my email was being flooded, my Twitter was being flooded, my Facebook was being flooded. Any possible way that you could contact me was like pretty much unusable, which is really hard to do when you're trying to figure out what is even going on. So it's like you're wading through all of this muck to try to be like, okay, where is this coming from? And, you know, especially as someone who has depression, doing that when, you know, with what I refer to as trash brain, which is like the stuff that depression tells you about yourself, where it's like, oh, you are worthless. Distrust anybody that's telling you that you're good. They just don't know that you suck, or they pity you, or whatever. Having that externalized by thousands of people and just flooded in any possible way to contact you is like really, really hard to deal with, and makes trying to figure out what's going on even harder.
How did you talk about a friend who was with you the entire time. How did you deal with this emotionally?
Badly, I guess, is the badly is definitely sort of where I was at for the longest time. The first few days I couldn't sleep because I would just have a panic attack the second I tried to not be doing something, like, or looking at something, or usually like trying to bag and tag and like screenshot all this, because it was like, you know, I was so trained at this point, anytime that there's any sort of harassment in games, especially directed at women, people would be like, oh, it's not real, or, oh, you know, it's not that bad. So I was documenting all of this because I'd just been in that habit for so long. And that felt like doing something. So when I wasn't doing that and I tried to sleep, I would just have panic attacks, and like I would slightly doze off and like have some very intense nightmares about everybody that I loved believing, you know, all of this stuff and leaving me. I wasn't able to drink or eat, and, you know, Alex Lifshitz, who was my boyfriend at the time, who I started dating a week before all of this, was really like trying to get me through it. And I don't know that I would still be here if he wasn't there. And if because he didn't leave my side for more than a couple hours for like the first year and a half of this, I think, just because it was like coming from all directions. And, you know, we were basically on the run together because neither one of us could go back to where we lived.
Wow. There's so many stories about online harassment and hate. How unique is your story?
The unique element of it, I think, is that it blew up to the degree that it did. But, I mean, Gamergate targeted so many people, too. It wasn't just me by any means. Mm. You know, it was a lot of people of color, a lot of trans women, a lot of other women, a lot of men who stood up for any of that. And one thing that I noticed when, you know, what happened to me caught such media attention is I had so many people come to me and be like, I feel like you're the only person who can remotely understand what happened to me. It wasn't quite the same, but it's so common. I mean, just think about how common stuff like domestic abuse is now. Why would people just only stick? Why would people who participate in that sort of thing not do that online? I mean, look at who's running the country right now and the fact that that's happening. You know, and there's a through line, you know, through what happened to me to the White House and back before me with a lot of stuff that was happening in like communities of women of color and trans people and stuff like that. Like, it's just been going back, stretching far back as long as the internet's existed. This has been such a problem. So it's incredibly common, and it's super frustrating and unfortunate.
For people who aren't familiar with Gamergate, can you describe what that means and what it is?
It got its name when the actor Adam Baldwin tweeted out a weird conspiracy video about me, which was super bizarre. And the I think they were trying to frame it like a scandal where I was allegedly sleeping with a game reviewer who had never reviewed my game, that I would have had to like go back in time in order to secure this review that didn't exist, and this all would have had to be for my free game about mental health. So, you know, that's already like weird conspiracy theory level like 100. And they actually like worked really hard to try and make it seem legitimate and did a lot of like sort of weird tactics that political opponents will use, like, oh, we're going to donate a lot to this charity to show that we're just like concerned about ethics and games journalism, and we're not harassing women. You know, let's make bots that yell at the people who are harassing that are also us at the same time, so that we can, you know, it was like some really weird, like, out there stuff about like just how coordinated this was.
Wow.
Like there were entire like GitHub repositories on like how to make fake accounts. Here's a bunch of propaganda to spam. Here's a bunch of emails that you can copy paste and send to advertisers or bosses or colleagues of these people to try to isolate and support folks like me. Like it was this massive campaign, and like major companies bent the knee. Like Intel pulled advertising off of a major game site because of this fake campaign, because one of the targets had written a piece for them. I think Adobe at one point like stepped in it, and Lexus stepped in it, and or Mercedes, I forget. It was like it was just so rapid fire, and all of this was happening so quickly too. And it's ridiculous. It's like there was so much fake news about specific people before we had the term fake news. And it's like it comes from this like sort of 4chan internet hoax stuff that can then be leveraged again to attack someone. And at least like I had a bit of an internet following, and you know, I built my career, I had my name, there was something else about me out there. But this happens frequently to people who don't have that. So if you are an employer and you're Googling a prospective candidate, and all you're seeing on that front page is like all this like bonkers made up stuff by like bloggers that, you know, if you're not technically competent, you might just see the first search result and this like ridiculous accusation and go, oh, I'm not going to hire that person. Or even if you are savvy, just be like, well, I don't want to get involved with this. It's so much easier to go with a candidate who doesn't have this. So like this can straight up ruin a lot of people's lives.
Well, after the break, we'll talk more. I'll ask you about 4chan and who these people actually are. And then we will also talk about what it will take to make the internet a safer place for everyone. Today, we're speaking with video game designer Zoe Quinn. When she ended her on-again, off-again relationship, her ex posted a massive manifesto about her that went viral. And then, as she's been saying, online mobs went after her. They broke into her accounts, harassed her family, her friends, threatened to rape and murder her. But rather than shut down her accounts, she started an online abuse crisis resource. Zoe Quinn is author of the book Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. She'll be speaking tonight at the Brava Theater in San Francisco at 7 o'clock, tomorrow night at City Lights in San Francisco, 7 o'clock, and October 5th, The Booksmith in San Francisco at 7:30. You can find more information about these events at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's On Point from WBUR in Boston. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be talking about the devastation in Puerto Rico. San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulin Cruz told CBS News, "It's life or death. People are starting to die already. I've put them in the ambulances when they're gasping for air." We decided to switch around some shows so we can spend the entire hour talking about Puerto Rico tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with video game developer Zoe Quinn about her new book, Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Zoe will be in conversation tonight at the Brava Theater in San Francisco, 7 o'clock. Tomorrow night, City Lights in San Francisco, 7 o'clock, and October 5th at the Booksmith in San Francisco at 7:30. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Leona who says, "What happened to your ex-boyfriend? Is he in jail? If not, why not?"
Nothing, I guess, is the short answer. So I got a restraining order, and this, I'm going to try to condense the legal nightmare as like much as I can, because like he was talking about posting a sequel, and I couldn't deal with that. And I tried talking to him once after all this happened, and it clearly was not, you know, it was weird to go back and look and be like, oh yeah, you know, the thing about abuse is like they're really good at getting in your head and controlling you. And even back then, I was still making excuses for him, being like, oh, maybe he just doesn't understand. He's a vegan for cruelty reasons. There's no way that, you know. Yeah, it's ridiculous. So I got a restraining order, and that just kind of made everything worse. And then I had to, like, fly back to Boston under total secrecy because there was a PI that another, like, an alt-writer had hired to try to find me at the time that this was all going on, which it sounds ridiculous to say out loud, but... nevertheless, I ended up having to go back for every restraining order violation, and that was such a circus. And he was crowdfunding from the internet to, you know, promising like, oh, I could auto-tune the transcripts and other funny things for them, because he was stoking the flames the whole way. And he even brought a date to one of the hearings, which was super weird, and that dragged on for like the better part of a year. He filed an appeal on the restraining order. I vacated it to just be, I'm like, fine, here's legal relief. Please leave me alone. This is not helping. I'd already relocated to Seattle. I tried to get a restraining order there because they had like cyber stalking built into the boilerplate of it. And I was denied on jurisdictional grounds and told that I would have to wait for him to violently reoffend again and for that to be a thing. And I'm just like, oh, well, that kind of defeats the purpose. After the judge had told me, "You're smart, kid. Just go offline and get a new career." I ended up getting a call from the DA, who was like, because I wrote about this, and she's like, that is not at all what should have happened. You do have a criminal harassment case here. Absolutely. Like, let's wait for all of this restraining order legal process to wrap up, and then let's file criminal harassment charges. And I'm like, all right. And I was mainly doing this because so many people are like, yeah, I want to see some justice. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, this sucks for me. I don't really think putting people in jail is going to do anything useful. You know, I'll fight it for that, you know, for people who need to see a victory like that. But when it finally came time, it had been years of this protracted legal battle. After I vacated my own restraining order, and then he appealed me vacating it and giving him the legal relief, it was like, okay, this is just clearly, like, I have to still interact with him constantly. This is the opposite of the thing that I needed. And having to relive that all the time and having to go there all, it was just, if I didn't have, like, pro bono representation and, like, people helping me with the costs of travel, I would have been super screwed.
Wow.
So when she wanted to file criminal harassment charges after all this, I'm like, actually, can you not? Like, I don't really want to do this for another few years. I can't really do this for another few years, especially because when you're the victim of a crime, it's not like the DA is representing you. They're representing the state, and you're just a witness. It doesn't really matter what happens to you. And, you know, like, they could have still pressed charges if they, like, regardless of what I wanted, but thankfully they listened. And I wrote about that, too, because I'm like, yeah, this entire process has been so much worse than just me dealing with it on my own. And I just don't want to deal with this. I don't. And it sucked because some people were, like, really disappointed in me for not fighting that anymore. But I feel like that's easy to feel like when you haven't tried to go through a years-long legal battle with anybody and don't know what's involved with that.
And now you have so many people asking you for advice about what to do based on your experience. And as you write in your book, one of the hardest questions from clients that you have to answer is, should I go to the police?
Yeah. Yeah, especially because, you know, online abuse disproportionately targets people of color. And in this country, considering the massive amount of police violence against people of color, it's like that's such a more complex thing than just like, oh, do I go to the police or not to file a report? So it's like, you know, every case of online abuse is different. It's more about what the person wants and working backwards from that rather than some one-size-fits-all solution.
The people who did this to you, who are they?
It depends. It's such a diverse cross-section. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got people who are the true believers who really do think that, you know, women or queer people or whatever are ruining everything. And, you know, these people tend to think that they're the good guys, you know, that they're fighting for what matters. And they don't see them. They don't really stop to consider what's actually going on. It's super easy for people to fall into that mindset, especially because there's a sense of community here. And a lot of people end up bitter and, like, wanting to lash out because they don't have a sense of community anywhere else. And sometimes it's even just about having that community. And I'm just dehumanized pixels on a screen, so it's not like I'm a real person, which is really underscored by the fact, like, anytime I tell a really good joke on Twitter or something, I usually get an apology email from a gamergamer who's like, oh no, I laughed at something you said, and I realize that you're a person now, and I know that's weird to say, and I'm like, it's not that weird, actually. I get that a lot. And same thing with when they got my phone number. I used to answer those calls, and they'd be like, is this Zoe Quinn? And I'd be like, yeah, did you not, like, you called me, dude. And they'd be like, oh, you know your phone number's on the internet, right? I'm like, yep. Mm-hmm. I'm aware. And they'd be like, oh. And then they'd frequently apologize.
Wow.
Like, oh, I'm sorry. It's like, right, because, you know, especially in my generation, like, who calls people anymore? So there's, like, that sense of humanity there.
So once they got you on the phone and heard your voice, they didn't know what to do.
Yeah, they didn't think that far ahead. It was more about this, like, you know, you still have the people who call up and scream death threats, and, you know, it doesn't really matter what you say. But there was definitely a segment that was, like, just had no idea what to do yet. And, you know, you get those folks, and then you get, like, the people that are really just trying to build a career off of this stuff because there is a cottage industry of harassing people on the internet and harassing people off the internet. And, like, these people that basically all want to be, like, Alex Jones or Rush Limbaugh or whatever, and can now try to do that with things like YouTube and GoFundMes and merchandising and all of these, like, different sites and build that platform of, like, having these 2 minutes hate against different marginalized people and, like, sort of pointing at them where to go. And for a lot of these people, I don't even know if they believe in the things they're saying so much as they're being opportunistic and seeing, you know, a way to build their brand and power and have something. And a lot of this is about power, fundamentally, regardless of if it's a true believer, if it's somebody just, you know, doing that sort of thing. because so frequently these people don't feel like they have any kind of power, and the internet gives you that instant access and that feedback and the ability to reach somebody and feel like you're impacting their life, and whether or not you actually think about that or what that means or want to hurt somebody in the first place, it's very easy for people to fall into doing that.
Today we are speaking with Zoe Quinn about her new book, Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. And we have one more event to add to the list. Zoe will be at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park right after today's show at 9 o'clock. I'm sorry, at noon. And then Zoe tonight will be at the Brava Theater in San Francisco, 7 o'clock, City Lights in San Francisco tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, and the Booksmith on October 5th at 7:30. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any stories to share, the other big question is, how should companies deal with this? I mean, they've had years to deal with this, and so many people who've been abused criticize companies like Facebook and Twitter for not really taking any action at all. And then after Charlottesville, they kind of woke up and said, oh, I guess we need to deal with this, with online racism, for example. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What about that, Zoe? Because after Charlottesville, so many people were saying that Twitter and Facebook needed to take some action. Can you talk about that? And what's the difference between the way companies respond to women, marginalized communities who are abused online, and something like racists and white supremacists using social media to talk about something like Charlottesville, to gather for an event like that?
See, that's, I think the fact that you said kind of is a really good thing. They do kind of feel like they should deal with it, but ultimately they are financially disincentivized from doing that because the internet runs on this economy of attention. It's all about traffic, eyeballs on a thing, and at the end of the day, there's no real difference in a spreadsheet between clicks and engagement that was generated because someone was trying to ruin someone else's life versus because someone actually liked something or it was like a cool piece of content or a really good cat picture. Like, there's no difference to these companies, and they need to have numbers go up. So, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that we see all these, like, if it's like a bad PR look, we'll get like kind of half measures and like these mealy mouthed, like, oh yeah, we're going to do something for real this time. And then if you look at it longitudinally, nothing happens. And it was the same for Gamergate. It was the same for after Leslie Jones was getting super harassed. That was like when they finally did something about that alt-right figurehead, Mila Yiannopoulos. So it's just like you get this little bump in seeming to care for PR, but then actually addressing the issues tends to just, as soon as that cools off, you see people care less and less. And I saw that doing casework as well. Like, I would go, like it very slowly tapered off so that things I could have got movement on when, you know, people were really talking about online harassment because Gamergate was a big thing versus like when that kind of died down a little bit, there's these spikes in having to look like they care. And ultimately, it comes back to this, it's easier to not do anything about it. Like, for example, Twitter has in its API this flag that can tell if an account is neo-Nazi or not. It's just this little thing that makes it so that content and those accounts do not show up in France or Germany because it's illegal to do so.
Oh, wow.
So instead of banning people, they end up just like, you know, protecting their own interests, and that's as far as it goes. Because there is this sort of backwards free speech absolutionist idea in tech right now that's like super prevalent in Silicon Valley, that's really frustrating, that looks at, and it's, you don't even have to look at this sort of thing as a freedom of speech issue really, because we've already been through all of this with the conversations about spam in the early 90s. That's more free speech than telling marginalized people you're going to kill them, which is not actually protected speech at all. And that was the thing, you know, people were like, hey, I need to be able to, I should be able to advertise my stuff as much as possible, as much as I want. That is free speech. That is my right. And ultimately what a lot of platforms did was say, well, actually, yes, it's free speech, but this is not what we designed the platform for. This is not, like, it's a quality issue. It's interfering with our ability to function as intended. And under that logic, we're going to start removing spam. And now that's like a $1 billion industry. And I don't see why it's like, did you build Twitter to make it so that Nazis could tell people they were going to gas them? No. Then you have a quality issue that you should maybe address here. And then you don't even have to get into the what counts as harassment. What is, you know, what are these things? You can just bypass that entirely.
Right. Well, that's the next question. Before we get to calls, just quickly, what changes would you like these top companies, especially Twitter and Facebook, to make?
Oh, that's such a long conversation.
Long conversation.
Yeah.
Well, what about the top? Well, what's at the top of your list?
I would say looking at things as being more opt-in rather than opt-out, especially as it comes to data and privacy and security and things like that. Because one of the things that makes it so difficult to deal with being targeted is usually you don't have control about if your home address and all of that info is out there being bought and sold by bunches of companies, and people don't usually even know that. So privacy and that sort of control over your own experience and your own information really needs to go back to the hands of people. And by making it opt-in and consent-focused, then people can more granularly control what they want to be out there about them rather than having to try to remove something from the internet, which is like trying to turn a hose off when it's raining. It's like, that's all right, well, I guess that helps, kind of.
Zoe Quinn is author of Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Let's hear from Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. So there's an old quandary. Do you answer trolls or do you ignore them? And I'm curious, since the writer must be kind of an expert in handling this by now, what are the specific steps one should take if one is trolled this mercilessly and viciously? Because I couldn't get through to Google when I had a complaint, so it's like, how do you get through, or what are the steps? Like, if, for instance, your credit card was stolen, there are steps you could take. What steps would you suggest people take?
I guess the biggest thing is figure out what your end goal is first. For some people, speaking up against, you know, and, you know, drawing the difference between trolling and actual abuse, trolling is like, you know, that used to be just pranks that you could play on your friends and get away with, and now it's turned into this thing where we incorporate death threats into that description. So, you know, like, let's just call it what it is, abuse. The way that you would deal with online abuse, it's like, do you want to fight back? Is that something that you, like, to visibly fight back? Do you think there's value in that? Or do you just want to not have to deal with it? And, you know, there's different steps you should take with each one. Generally, people should have what I like to call better digital hygiene. So you should have unique passwords for all of your accounts. And there's these cool things called password managers now that make that super easy. So you don't even have to know what your own passwords are.
Are those password managers safe?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I would wonder that.
They have pretty good, they've gotten it to the point where it's pretty good encryption
okay.
stuff. I use them and I'm very, I've been able to not have any incidents with that. If anything, it's been harder to recover. I can't recover one of my accounts because it's too secure. So I'm pleased with that. Another thing is go and just religiously Google yourself, Google your home address, see if it, try to find sites like Spokio, whitepages.com, see if you're on there, file opt-out requests. If you're not sure how to do that, Google the site's name and then opt-out request, because usually they make it very difficult to actually do that.
Spokio, how do you spell that?
Like spoke.
Uh-huh.
And then, oh.
Got it.
But there's like so many third-party information broker sites like that. Mm-hmm. So you got to really be thorough. Another thing would be to, you can do credit freezes, which I think a lot of people after the Equifax thing are a bit more savvy on how to do that. So specifically with credit card information and fraud, you might want to just do that. You know, review privacy settings on all of your accounts to just really make sure that what's out there about you on your own accounts is under your control and at the level that you want it to be. You know, but that's just like such a preliminary thing. But responding to or not responding to should come down to, you know, do you think there's value in publicly fighting this? Are there people watching that you want to see, you know, have that smackdown? And picking your battles very strategically to be in line with your ultimate goals. And there's no shame in saying, you know, I don't want to deal with this at all. This is too much. I just need this to stop. And there's nothing wrong with that.
I'm really concerned about teenagers and young people because all of this is just a part of their lives. And high school is hard enough, but to add technology and all this to it, what advice would you give to parents?
One of the first things that I would say is like just try to get tech literate at a basic level so that if this does happen to your kid, you can be like, okay, this is what we got to do. We got this together. And like, you know, treat it like I'm going to help protect you thing rather than a, oh no, what happened? Like, because it's so easy for, we've had younger people come to me for help and have been like, you know, often parents are freaking out or they're trying to remove their kids' access to the internet, which is, I can understand why you would want to do that. But for so many people, especially people who are like queer or depressed, a lot of our support networks are online too. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that you're not accidentally taking a vital support network away from your kid by just knee-jerking and saying, oh, just we're not going to, you know, we're not going to deal with that. We're just going to go offline. And going offline doesn't stop other people from escalating the attacks on you either. So it's important to just really the best thing you can do is get educated and don't be afraid of the internet as or see it as just something that only bad things happen on.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ken. Let's go next to Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thank you for this, and I'm really sorry about the subject, but I believe it was on your show a little while ago where you were mentioning there was this woman artist in Los Angeles who was a victim of some of this and then started collecting photos. These were the unwanted texts of the genital photos with the threats, and she was actually doing a gallery show of the men's genital photos with the threats. And I just think that this is an amazingly powerful tool to just make it clear, you know, how real this is, particularly to men. I mean, if they go into this, they're going to get it. I mean, and I was hoping this show would go on the road because I believe it was Los Angeles, but maybe this is the kind of thing local people can do too, where they collect these photos with the threats and put this issue, like, you know, in the real, you know, on the wall, and document it just for other people to see and understand, like, how bad this is. Okay, I'll take comments on here. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would worry about... So I worry about things that are retaliatory in nature by doing something like distributing nude photos of someone. It's like, yeah, what they did was super over the line and not cool. But at the same time, I don't know that the solution is posting non-consensual, like distributing non-consensual nudes of someone. It's like, I feel like there's a better through way that doesn't like end up with this, oh, let's just do the same crappy things back and forth to each other. Mm. You know, which is not the case. It's like such, and I hesitate to even say that because it's like you start getting into that, do we punch Nazis or not territory? And I'm firmly in the camp of yes, punch Nazis. But when it comes to anything you make public, you sort of give up control over how, like, what happens next. And that's really where my concern comes into. It's like, are you okay with the fact that this could have unintended collateral damage? What if somebody is sending you, like, a genital photo that isn't actually theirs? You know, like, what sort of collateral damage is here? What kind of accuracy are we actually fighting back with? And is there anybody who's innocent that's getting hurt in the crossfire? And that's, you know, a big thing with anti-abuse stuff in general is, like, are we making something that can be used to hurt innocent people?
Right.
And that's something we really have to be cognizant of when we figure out the solutions.
Well, thank you for calling in, Mark. I wanted to ask you, Zoe, just about the connections between some of these hate groups and Donald Trump. You write that Gamergate wasn't really about video games at all so much as it was a flashpoint for radicalized online hatred that had a long list of targets before and after my name was added to it. The movement helped solidify connections between white supremacist movements, conspiracy theorists, dispassionate hoaxers who derive a sense of power from disseminating information. This patchwork of Thanksgiving ruined racist uncles might look like and sound like a bad joke, but they became a real force behind giving Donald Trump the keys to the White House. Where do you see that going? These groups have clearly been empowered.
Yes, yes, they absolutely have been. It was weird getting the emails I did after the day after the election. I got like a variety of people being like, oh no, you were right. I got, hey, thanks for getting Donald Trump elected. And I got, hey, haha, Donald Trump is elected. We're going to really get you now type thing. It was very weird. And it's like, you know, my role in that is so small. And really, you know, Gamergate was more of a symptom than a cause of anything. Gamergate did help solidify like a lot of infrastructure online for organizing and build some of the celebrities that we see now. Like one of the guys who started that whole Pizzagate thing, you know, cut his teeth on coming after me and was the same guy that hired that PI. You know, Mila Yiannopoulos got a whole young audience now by targeting me. Like, I was one of the first people that he really built this thing on. And that's just kind of like, it's just this weird, horrible constellation of, I don't know if I can swear on this, so I'm just going to leave it at that. And yeah, it was like super bizarre to see someone responsible for Breitbart, which was directly responsible for taking what happened to me and putting it in, like, really spotlighting it among the neo-Nazi crowd in the White House. And that's, like, I don't even really fully... I can't wrap my head around that, you know? I'm not sure where it goes. other than we've got to focus on taking care of each other, because I think, if nothing else, this election has made it painfully clear to maybe people who didn't know this before that we cannot wait for institutions or people in power to come and take care of us. We don't, you know, as gloom and doom as I have been about the institutional issues that cause online abuse, I think there's hope in the fact that we can get together and fight back now. We don't have to wait. We can't wait. We have to take care of each other. And there, are, you know, this book is meant to be like, here are all the tools I've used. Now you know. You go and do it for other people and teach other people. And like, let's not wait. Let's not wait for people to magically care. Let's be our brother's keeper. Let's be the solution instead of just the problem.
I mentioned a couple of the organizations earlier: Lesbian Tech, Trans H4CK. Are there other groups out there that people might not know about that are doing really important work right now?
Yes. Oh, God, there's so many. I put a lot in the back of the book, and I'm trying, like, I'm not quite awake yet, so I'm trying to, like, brain really hard here, and it's just like the hamster is falling asleep on the wheel.
Yeah.
I know the Coral Project is doing a lot of really good work to make comment sections not suck. That you've got people like the Southern Poverty Law Center is doing a lot of stuff about online hate that's quite good. You've got, in just the tech side of thing, Code Liberation's really great. Girls Make Games is really great. God, there's so many.
We can put more on the website.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Okay.
What's next for you?
I am trying to make games again. It's really cool. I didn't know that I was going to be able to, because, like, for the longest time, I would sit down to work on something and just nothing would come out. And, I have PTSD. There's, like, actual issues getting in the way of me being able to do the thing I did. But, you know, I'm a game developer because I can't help it. So eventually I was just daydreaming about this weird technical problem. And I'm like, oh, I wonder if this thing would work. And, you know, I went and sat down and coded it, and it worked. I'm like, oh, okay, well, what if I do this? And then I just found myself doing it again. So now I'm finishing up a sex comedy game based on the works of a niche Kindle erotica Amazon author named Chuck Tingle. That's, like, this absurdist thing about, you know, our whole mission statement is, like, making a sex comedy where nobody's the butt of the joke, and it's very loving, it's, like, super queer, and super fun and funny, and, like, trying to, you know, use comedy to start off the tone, like, it kind of a high fun thing, and then you undercut that with, like, really emotionally heavy tones about, like, you know, what do you do if you're in this, like, long-term married relationship and you're not sure if the other person's gotten bored with you, or, you know, how do you hook up with someone with while still being genuine and true to yourself, but still want to impress them, and where's the line on that, and, like, how do you take care of yourself, and how do you deal with a messy breakup, how do you deal with all of these things, like, show, like, compassionate, fun, goofy sides of that, and use, like, comedy and games as sort of a healing thing and compassionate and sweet thing.
We don't have time to take Christian's call, but she wants to let you know that she's been a woman in tech for 20 years and feels very empowered by your work.
Oh, that means a lot. And it's so cool to see people that have been here for a long time and are still here.
Well, Zoe, really, hats off to you for speaking out. It's so important.
Thank you.
I mean, it's not easy because, look, you're doing 4 events in the next couple days.
Yeah.
Well, keep at it, really. You're making a big difference. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Zoe Quinn is author of Crash Override: How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Zoe will be at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park today at noon. Tonight, she'll be at the Brava Theater in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow night at City Lights in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. And October 5th at the Booksmith in San Francisco at 7:30. Coming up tomorrow, we are going to talk about the devastating news coming out of Puerto Rico. We hope you can join us for that. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Thanks to Ali Budner for producing today's show. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. It's Your Call.